Right, good afternoon. Good Erev Shabbos, everybody. We're talking today about what I consider to be one of the most interesting business issues to do with the world that I inhabit, the more sort of, I would suppose I'd call it the more scholarly world, if that's the way to describe it. And I have to preface what I'm going to talk about with a little story. The story goes like this. About 20 years ago, there's a company, it was less than 20 years ago, 1995, what is that? 17 years ago. There was a company in the United States, I was still living in London, and they started producing translations of Gemaras, which everyone was really very, very excited about, and it is an amazing project, and it's, all of you will recognize it as the Art Scroll Gemara, all right? You know, if you've never seen it, it's this red cover, this book, which they finished the project in 2003, or even earlier than that, and then they started reprinting it again. It's a phenomenal book. The interesting thing was that in 1994-95, when they started, one of the schools in London, I don't think it was my school, but I remember, it's either it was or it was another Jewish school, contacted the Art Scroll. The first Gemara was I think Brochus. They started from the beginning. They worked all their way through. And Brochus is a nice Gemara to teach in school. You know, a lot of kids learn that. That's one you teach to kids. So one of the schools in London wanted to reprint, and it wasn't a whole chapter of the Gemara. It was about 10 pages of Talmud. Right? And the beauty of it is that you have the English translation and notes and explanations, and for teachers, it's very helpful. And they thought it'd be no problem. So they called the Art Scroll people, long distance phone call to New York, whatever their address is, 2nd Avenue in Brooklyn, and they got back the following message. And the message was very terse, it was very short and short to the point, and they were told that if you do this, you copy this, these pages, then you'll be hearing from our lawyers in London. We have lawyers representing us in England. And to put a fine point on it, they said that you will be sued, right? And what would they be sued on? The laws of copyright. This wasn't San Siro, Art Scroll. The San Siro is another story. I'll come to that in a minute. And the school could not do it. And when you look at their statement at the front here, I just brought it with me, it says like this: no part of this volume may be reproduced in any form, capital letters, photocopy, electronic, media, or otherwise, even for personal study group or classroom use, without written permission from the copyright holder. That's a pretty heavy number. You don't usually see such a big copyright. Normally you see a book, and it says, all rights reserved, with a little C. There's like a sign. But to have such a big notice over here is really quite amazing. The only time they allow you to do it is that except by a reviewer who wishes to quote brief passages in connection with a review written for inclusion in magazines or newspapers. So when do they allow you to copy? When, obviously, it's going to give them a bit of, I suppose you would call it, free publicity. Because if you're reviewing something and you quote from Art Scroll, then everyone will read the review and say, oh, I must get hold of the Art Scroll book. All right? Art Scroll has been a very interesting development. They have taken the whole concept of a Talmud and other books that they do and have moved it into the 21st century. And again, don't get me wrong, it's a phenomenal piece of work. And they're entitled to protect their rights. But to the point where they would say that they would sue you for copying one or two pages of Talmud, that's where I have to say that I find that a bit severe, to put it mildly. And when this whole story came about, I started looking into the whole question of copyright. You know, we're talking about business ethics this week, and the whole idea of cheating and, you know, sort of being honest in business, etc. And I remember when the use of copying machines, I'm not sure, even nowadays, you know, everyone is very bound in the office to the copying machine. They used to put on the copying machine, I don't know if it's still there, a whole string of notices warning you what you could and what you could not photocopy. And there's a lot of stuff there which you're not allowed legally to photocopy. It always bugged me because, you know, whenever you apply for anything, they need a copy of a driving license. And if you look on that little notice on the copy machine, it says one of the things you're not supposed to copy is any sort of official document, such as a passport or a driving license. You're not supposed to photocopy it. So how are you supposed to get a copy of it? I'm not quite sure. It's like a... And whatever it is, it's a real problem. And these rights of copyright, as we would call them, is something which in the world today we take for granted that exists. Somebody who writes a book, or somebody who produces an invention, he invents whatever it may be, you know, there's all these types of things. If you ever watched, there's a TV show which my wife records, it's a Friday night show, and it's called The Shark Tank. What is The Shark Tank all about? It's a number of entrepreneurs, and people come and present their product, and they want to get money from these guys to invest in their business. And the first question that they always ask, more or less, is, have you protected your product? In other words, do you have a lawyer? Have you gone through the process of copyright, of protecting what you've invented? And in some cases, the answer is yes, and very often, surprisingly, the answer is no. And then you can see immediately they all pull back. They all say, well, you know, before we do anything, you've got to protect your rights. And it's fascinating. That show is worth, if you have a DVR recorder, it's always worth recording because you see how the business mind works. Very, very interesting to see. Not so much, I mean, they're not particularly nice people, I have to say, but in terms of the way that they think, that's very, very interesting. So take a step back and let's say to ourselves, ask ourselves the basic question, and I'm going to ask it in terms of Jewish books, because this is where the story really sort of started, as far as I'm concerned. And the question will be very simply, is there a concept of copyright in Torah, in Torah literature, in producing Gemaras or producing commentaries? Is there a concept, in other words, is there a history of copyright existing on Torah publications, or do we say, which is completely the argument against copyright, that you know what, Torah is meant for everybody. Torah is meant to be something which everybody is meant to be connected to, be it reading a translation of the Tzenarena, or be it reading a section of Talmud or Rashi or whatever it may be. In which case, the concept of copyright is absolutely foreign. Should be foreign to Torah books, because you want everybody to have the book. Why should you limit it to one or two people and not allow people to reproduce it and to photocopy it on to spread, as they say in Christianity, to spread the gospel, pardon the expression. In other words, to make the word get out there, right? And here we've got a real dilemma. And I'll tell you the story. The story runs like this, and this is a number of modern cases which came up in the 80s and 90s in Yerushalayim. The first one that came up, and I'll talk about Sonsina, that's the second one I'm going to talk about. The first case that came up was in 1984. And what happened was, and this is where I found an article on this, by somebody called Sheila Rafael. Rabbi Sheila Rafael, Zichron Livracha, died a very young man. He was 54 years old. And he was the Av Beit Din, he was the head of the Beit Din Yerushalayim. Great Talmud Chacham, and I think was slated, I think at that time, a candidate for chief rabbi of Israel, very special man. And he got sick, very young man, and Nebuch, he died very young. Before he died, he issued one of these rulings, which is found in a magazine that was produced in Israel, Torah Misinai it was called. And in this magazine, he writes about the whole issue of copyright. It's fascinating. And what was the story? The story goes like this, and some of you will recognize the name of the book. In 1943 in Budapest, things were obviously very serious in terms of what was going on in the war. The Germans had not yet arrived, but there were a lot of refugees who were making their way into Budapest. And one of the refugees that arrived there was a gentleman by the name of Rav Shlomo Teichtal. Rav Shlomo Teichtal, Zichrono Livracha, was a great, great Gaon in Torah. He came originally, I think, from Czechoslovakia, around that area. I'm not sure exactly his hometown. But he ended up in Budapest. And in 1943, he managed to get a sefer published. Remarkable. And the sefer was called Eim HaBanim Smecha. Eim HaBanim Smecha is a book which was written by a gentleman who in his early years was an absolute ardent follower of the Satmar Hasidim. He was a Satmar, he may have even come from that town, I don't know. And his attitude towards the new Yishuv, the developments in Eretz Israel, as you can imagine, was not very positive. Better to stay in Europe, better to be there. You know, a lot of you will know this firsthand, these particular comments. And Rav Teichtal was, in his younger years, known as being a Kanoi. He was against everything to do with Zionism. In 1943, By the time he wrote this book, and he wrote it balpin, you read this book, and there's two things you realize straight away. Number one, that the man was a gaon; he knew everything by heart because he didn't have books with him. And number two, that this man was crying his eyes out when he wrote this book, because he says in the book, and he says it over and over again, we made a big mistake. We made a big error. The rabbis of the pre-war generation were wrong. And he says it again and again and again. We should have sent people to Eretz Yisrael when we could have sent them. We should have encouraged Aliyah before the Second World War when we could have encouraged people to go. I know there was a problem, certificates and whatever, but the negativity of the leadership was so problematic that for most Jews it wasn't even a possibility. Nobody thought of it. And he writes this, and in 1943 he wrote this sefer. And it was published in Budapest in 43. And it survived the war somehow. And it sort of went out of print for many years. In 1984, an interesting group of people in Israel, of the more like from the Mekkas of Rav Yeshiva, people who are much more sort of towards the right wing of the Zionist movement, religious Zionism, they found the sefer. And they couldn't believe what they were reading. They couldn't believe it. They just saw this sefer and they said, this is dynamite. We've got to reprint this sefer. And what happened was that they contacted the family. I think some of his children survived. And the family said, we'll agree to it on one condition. The condition is that they print a hakdama, an introduction with the book. And in the introduction, it will explain their father's change of mind, what he went through, what happened to him, a bit of the history, to explain what was going on. Why he came out with such a book in 1943 after everything he went through, and they agreed, absolutely, this was absolutely right. Unbeknown to all of these people, another group of people, whoever they were, got hold of a publisher and got a copy of the original 1943 book, and they pirated it. They published it. And they did, without the introduction, without any word of explanation. And that book I've actually seen. I've seen a copy of it. If you try hard, you might be able to find copies of it around. And of course, it was published against the will of the family because they wanted a special introduction. The updated version, which has now been translated into English, is really a much, much better version of the whole book, and it gives you the sources and the references. It's a wonderful sefer. We need to talk about it as a separate discussion. But what happened was that the whole court case came in front of the Jerusalem Beth Din. In 1984, what they had to decide was whether this pirating of the book should be stopped. All right. In other words, is there copyright? Does copyright exist in this area on this particular book? And this was the Shiloh. In 1991, in New York, before Art Scroll got going, this is case number two. Case number two was that there was a translation of Talmud from the 1930s, mainly in England, which was known as the Sonsino Talmud. A lot of people recognize it. And Sonsino did a wonderful thing. They not only published the Talmud Hebrew with English together, they also did it as a separate English-only volume. And it was the standard translation for all those years, from the 1930s through to the 1990s. Was it user-friendly? Was it easy to follow? No. But was it the only translation that existed in English? Yes. And a lot of people were just, it was a major piece of work. In 1990, in New York, again, who are these people? I don't know. They decided to copy the Sonsino Talmud with one difference. They took the book, they literally photocopied the whole thing, and they just left out the title page. So when you get it, there's no indication that this is the Sonsino Talmud. The trouble is you hold one next to the other, the Sonsino next to this copy, and you can see it's exactly the same. And this again became a court case in New York. And it was taken to court because this was pirating a copy of a sefer which should never have been copied like that. And again, the same question arose. Can you enforce copyright in this case? So there was two modern cases, one about Eimah Banim Smecha, this sefer, and the other one about the pirating of the Sonsino Chumash. I was a bit upset with my shul in Fairlawn because I looked once for a Gemara, and they had a copy of this pirated Sonsino. I was really upset with them that they bought it. Why was it done? Because it was sold much cheaper than the regular one. All right, all of this pirating is about business. It's not about wanting to spread Torah. It's about wanting to make business. I mean, I'm sorry to be blunt about it, but the Sansino, let's say, was sold as a set for, I don't know, $1,000, and this pirated set you could buy for $500. So, you know, people started buying it because, you know, it was available. And it's very, very difficult. It's very, I would say it almost becomes an emotional topic. Do you take these things to a Bet Din? Do you take them to a Din Torah? What do you do about it? Because as I said, the two arguments are very strong. On the one hand, protect the rights of the person producing the book. On the other hand, Yagdil Torah, you want Torah to be spread, you want people to learn. If you're stopping people copying and spreading Torah, what are you going to do? And the story in 1984 with Eima Bonim Smecha goes like this. And this is what Rabbi Rafael, the head of the Bet Din, writes. And he says, I'm going to do a bit of research. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to look back in Jewish history. Fascinating. And he says, I'm going to go back to the year 1580. 1580 is a long time ago, right? That's when Shakespeare was living. Yerushalayim. This is all in Yerushalayim. New York was much later. I don't know which Bet Din dealt with it in New York, but my guess is the Bet Din of America. That would be my guess. But I don't know who it was. But Yerushalayim was the Bet Din of Jerusalem. Jerusalem based it. And what happened was that they started looking around, and they found that in 1580, long time ago, in Krakow, Poland, there was a case as follows. And it's unbelievable. What happened was that Ramosha ben Maimon, the famous Rambam, his books had been reprinted over and over and over again. And what happened was that somebody in Krakow, and this is 100 years after printing started, remember it started around 1470, 1475, this is 100 years later, somebody decided that they were going to pirate, that's the word they use, or equivalent in Hebrew, the copy of Rambam. Rambam's Yad, the copy of Halachic decisions that the Rambam made, which is now very well known, very famous. And they tried to pirate it. So obviously what happened was that the original printer of the Rambam, of Maimonides, went to a Bet Din. And he went in front of the great Gaon, Rav Moshe Isserles. Rav Moshe Isserles was the rabbi of Krakow. If you go to Krakow, today, you will see his grave, which is still preserved in the Krakow cemetery. Right, there's a tree growing over it. It's fascinating. The actual makeup of that cemetery is something else. And so many great tzaddikim are buried there, but the center, they go there Lag BaOmer. Because Lag BaOmer was when he died, it was his yahrzeit. And it became like a place where people used to congregate on Lag BaOmer. You couldn't get to Meron in Israel, so you would go to the Ramah, his grave in Krakow, in Poland. And what happened was that the Ramah heard the Din Torah. On the one hand, people were trying to justify publishing the book. On the other hand, they said, but there's a copyright. It's already been established that Reuven publishes it, and not Shimon. And Shimon wants to publish it. So what the Ramah said is a very interesting distinction. He said that he looked in Talmud, and he said there's two categories, there's two definitions. The first definition, I'll quote you the Hebrew phrase, is mamit chiyute. Mamit chiyute means that you diminish somebody's livelihood. You don't destroy it, but instead of getting 100, he only gets 50. There's a second concept in the Talmud, which is pasik chiyute. Pasik chiyute means that you literally take away the whole 100. He was getting $100 and now he gets zero. And the Ramah said that there is a difference. In the case of Mamit, where you diminish the livelihood, but now you're getting 50 and the other guy's getting 50, he says there are absolute sources to say that it's not the most admirable thing to do, but it's not absolutely forbidden. But if you are completely diminishing that person's livelihood by selling something, for instance, the Rambam that was being sold, the copies of the book, let's say were being sold for $100, and you come along and sell them for 50, everybody will buy it from you. Nobody's going to buy the $100 book because you can get it for 50. So you've destroyed the other guy's livelihood. Said Rav Moshe Isserles at that early stage, that's the situation here, and he absolutely said there's a copyright on this situation, or the equivalent words, and that book which was being pirated, which was being published at the cheaper rate, has to stop being published. And of course they had the force of the Bet Din in Krakow, and he could issue a cherem if necessary, put people into excommunication. Unbelievable. And that was one of the earliest cases of the situation, not necessarily of a new book. This was a book that was already published, already printed, but it's already giving you an idea that there is what is called Zechut Ayotzer, the rights of people who create a book to protect their creation. Yod L'chaim. And that's exactly what he quotes from the Gemara. It's the Gemara in Bava Batra, and that's the expression. The second case is 200 years down the line. Chatam Sofer. Chatam Sofer was one of the greats in Hungary, in Presburg, and very famous. And he had a massive debate with another great rabbi, Rav Mordechai Banet. Mordechai Banet has a descendant who actually comes to this camp, Mrs. Banet, and she's not here this trip. She may be here on the next trip. And she's a great lady. And Rav Mordechai Banet was approached, he had the first approach, and it was about a machzor called the Rödelheim machzor. Now those of you who have any connection with the Germanic community will know that the standard of Sephorim in that community was the publishing at Rödelheim. Where Rödelheim is in Germany, I'm not quite sure, but it was known as being the, you know, it was like the highest standard of publishing, to be exact, and everything was done, you know, sort of commotion tzarich as necessary. It's quite amazing. I have at home for my grandfather, I have a Chumash which was published in Rödelheim, I think in the early 1900s. And many will have, there's like a wonderful little siddur that they did, which my wife, when she went to Breuer, she got it for graduation. She got a Rödelheim siddur, which is, again, according to the Nusach of Frankfurt, and it's fascinating. And the Rödelheim, this was the case, it was about the Machzorim. And what happened was that they went to Rav Mordechai Banet, and somebody from another town called Durenfurt. Now where Durenfurt is, I don't know. I should bring a map, I suppose, and show all these places. And the people in Durenfurt wanted to copy the Rödelheim Machzor. They wanted to make a photo, whatever copy, not photocopying, but whatever they did, they wanted to reproduce it from a different source. And Rav Mordechai Banet said to them, yes, you can do it. He had no objections whatsoever. And of course there was an appeal. And the appeal went to the Chatam Sofer, to Rav Moshe Sofer in Presburg. And Rav Moshe Sofer says, with all due respect to Rav Banet, I can't agree with his decision. He says like this, and his language is phenomenal. And you'll appreciate this, because as much as Rav Moshe Sofer was a great Rav, he had a business head on him. He understood what people, the thinking of a businessman when he would go and create such a publication. And he puts it like this, and I must quote this to you because it's so amazing. He says, "Me petty, who would be a fool? Yachnis atzmo, that would bring himself, besofek hefsed kama alofim, that he might lose thousands, v'titbatel melechet adafus chas v'shon." In other words, he says, if somebody's going to print a book and invest so much money in printing the book and realize that he can't protect his book because somebody else is going to print it for half the price, then what idiot is going to invest in such a project when it's guaranteed to fail? I'm investing $10,000 in this project and somebody comes along and can produce it for $5,000. In other words, sell the book for half price in a different publication. You know what that's going to do? That's going to stop me producing it in the first place. And what happens in the end? The book doesn't get published. And of course, what happens there, he says, titbatel melechet hadafus. The whole activity of printing is going to stop. And if this is the case, says Chatam Sofer, he says, in such a case, you can argue, Yagdil Torah, that we should have more Torah, people should study, but you know what? You've got to protect people's rights in business. Fascinating. And this is coming from a rabbi who really, you know, was very much, he had his own yeshiva, he was so famous in his day, and yet he absolutely established, as far as he was concerned, a right, a copyright, a right of protection of an existing book in this circumstance. Now, so far so good, because this is about books which already were in existence. The question that we have, which Raphael had to deal with, was a new book. Is there such a concept of copyright where something is new? Is there a concept that you can protect your creation, as it were? And it's so interesting that you would say, if you asked, and I did this in school once, I said, what do you think? What would be anything in the Torah that springs to mind of a posuk or an idea to relate to this? And immediately somebody put up his hand, one of the boys, and he said, "Sogat gavul." He said, you're trespassing in somebody else's area. Someone has established a boundary of publishing a book, and what you've done is moved in. So, according to the Torah, that's not allowed. I'm not allowed to encroach on somebody else's property. It's interesting, because none of the rabbis say that. I find it amazing. None of them talk about a sogas gavul. I see the expression used in certain books which are published in Israel, Issur ha-sogas gavul. they actually put that in Hebrew, that there's a prohibition of encroaching into somebody else's territory. In other words, copying this book. But you know something, you look in the literature, in the rabbinic literature, they don't use that expression at all. Because Asogas Gavul is not really, if you want to stretch it to the idea of copyright, that's a stretch. And they weren't prepared to say this. And I'll show you where it goes. It's fascinating. It goes into again, we're in the 19th century, and a new sefer comes out. Now we're going to talk about new Sfarim. There was a commentary on Shulchan Aruch, which a lot of people recognize, called Primogodim. Primogodim came out, I don't know what year it was, and again, somebody got exclusive rights to publish the Primogodim. And immediately what happens, as soon as one is exclusive, there's another Yidl comes along and says, I want to publish it as well. And the whole case came before somebody called Reb Shaul Natanzon. Reb Shaul Natanzon was one of the very, very great poskim, one of the great rabbis in the 19th century in Lemberg. And he says the following, Umasim b'chol yom, he says it happens every single day, Shamatfis chibur, somebody who publishes, this is a different story to the previous cases, because this is a new book. He says, anyone who publishes a book, yesh lo ulabakocho zechut, they have a right, they have a way of protecting their book. And he assumes that this is absolutely 100% the way the halakha is, and he says, there's no question about it. He quotes from the Haflor, who was the Rebbe of Reb Moshe Sofer, the Reb Pinchas Horowitz in Frankfurt. He quotes from him and he says that this rabbi, Rabbi Horowitz, gazar be'atzmo, he made a decree, al kol ha-madpisim, on all of the printers, shelo yadpisu bilti reshuto, that if they're going to print any of his books, they've got to ask his permission. So he created a copyright. And those books were protected. So there's no question, according to Rav Natanzon, that a copyright does exist. And again, I'm not going to go through all of the sort of technicality of it, but it is essentially the same language that we have already seen. In this discussion, another rabbi got involved. It's amazing how these things mushroom. And another rabbi got involved by the name of Reb Yitzchak Shmelkes. Reb Yitzchak Shmelkes was someone very famous in Poland, the Beis Yitzchak. Very, very great decider of Jewish law. I've seen a picture of this guy. Very pretty, awesome looking guy. A serious beard, you know, sort of really long beard. And this gentleman, Beis Yitzchak, he says no. He says in this case, he's going to disagree in principle with what Reb Natanzon said. And I'll read what he says, because this is the counter-argument to the whole thing that we've been saying. Till now, it's like a breeze. Everybody holds a copyright. Says Rav Shmelkes, he says no. He says that there's a difference, he says, Hamtza'a regila. He says when somebody invents something, whatever it is, a new pillow, right? You see on the TV now, somebody's invented a new pillow so you can sleep better at night. That's the sort of thing, shekayemet bo zechut yotzrim. Then we know that you have to protect your invention. You go nowadays, there's a whole legal study, the law of patents, a patent lawyer, you know, you have to get hold of somebody like that to protect your invention. That's, he says, is understood. But he says there's a difference between that, lebein divrei Torah, to the words of Torah. Why? Because he says in the Torah, and he quotes Pesukim. Phenomenal, this man. He says, Re'ei, the Pasuk says, Si limadati etchem chukim u'mishpatim, I've taught you laws and I've taught you statutes. Kasher tzivani Hashem, as God has commanded me, this is Moshe Rabbeinu talking, and he says, the rabbis say, Mani b'chinam, I have given you the Torah, I didn't charge you a penny for it. Alright? Afatem nami b'chinam. So you also get the, as it were, so you should get the Torah from Moshe for nothing. He won't charge you. You learn Torah. Torah should be without any sort of price. Moshe nahagba tovat ayin. It says another quote that Moses had a good eye. In other words, he favored the Jewish people. V'notna liYisrael, he gave it, or nitna Israel, he gave it to Israel. V'alav ha-katuv omer, tov ayin hu yivorach, the good of eye should be blessed. And again, says Rabbi Shmelkes, and it's interesting, you would think after all of these years with the Ramon, with all the other rabbis, that this, the idea of copyright should be established. He says, no. When it comes to Torah, Yagdul Torah, let everybody get hold of the Torah, as many people as possible. And if it means that you end up copying the book and you spread the word in that direction, then do it. He says, that's what you do. But, he says, you know, I've got a problem. And the problem is not from a Jewish perspective, but from a secular perspective. Fascinating. This is a rabbi who was absolutely central in the Jewish community. But he says like this. He says that even though I am not comfortable with the whole idea of stopping Torah being published, there is a concept called Dina de Malchuta. There's the law of the land. And the law of the land is that copyright exists. He's talking the 19th century. And even more so today, you know, as I said, you've got lawyers who are specialists on this. And he says that even if I can't justify copyright in Jewish law, I have to accept that it exists in the law of the country. Amazing. And therefore, he says in the end, you know what, I'm going to have to uphold the decision of the copyright and stop the other copy being published, but not even from the law of Torah, but it's Dina de Malchut, it's the law of the land, which is so unexpected. You know, who expects a rabbi to even bring that into the discussion? And he does. And the bottom line of all of what was said is that there has to be essentially two approaches to this. So for many rabbis, it's obvious. There is a copyright law. Finished. And the fact is that, you know, as the Chatam Sofer says, what idiot would invest in publishing a book if they couldn't protect their publication? Fine. But says Rabbi Shmuel, because you know what? I'm not even convinced that that's the case. And he had the gall to stand up and do this. And he says that even though I'm not convinced, I'm going to have to give in because the law of the land is still that copyright is important. In 1946, here comes a really interesting story. In 1946, the Rebbetzin of the Chofetz Chaim, Mrs. Kagan, Frieda Kagan, I wonder if anyone knew her. I don't know whether she left Poland or whether she made it to America. I don't know. I know that Rabbi Zaks, his son-in-law, was teaching in Yeshiva. I know he was in YU. But whether the Rebbetzin of the Chofetz Chaim made it to New York, I don't know. But in 1946, one of his books was published in New York. It's a book called Avas Chesed, one of his Musa books. All right, and it's famous. And it's now been translated into English and so on. And she had a letter from her husband, because everybody wanted to know, what did the Chofetz Chaim say about all this? He was a great decider of Jewish law. What did he say? And she quotes the following, very interesting. She says like this, that, where is it? Hang on a second, let me find the words. It was a Hakdama B'Yiddish. It was not even in Hebrew, it was in Yiddish. And she had a letter from her husband, Shabala Natanla Ba'ofen Biladin. Her husband said that you, my Rebbetzin, have the absolute right Latamid forever, Zechus had pasat svarav to print his books. She was given the copyright by her husband, the rabbi. Unreal. And he says, "Vayu eile lala michyasa," and he was concerned that she should have sustenance. She should be the paranosa from the publication of the books. And therefore, she says, she adds, "Ein lo rashud lad pishum sefer shel Chofetz Chaim." She said that you can't reprint any of his books, either partially or totally, b'shum safa shehi, in any language, lo b'medina Poland, not even in Poland, she says, b'lo b'medina t'acherod, or not anywhere else, and this was happening in New York already. And she says that was the decision that her husband, the letter that her husband left with her to guarantee her livelihood. Unreal. And they expire as well. So, but he was saying that this will be forever, according to the Torah, according to religious law. Fascinating. Because if you go by Rabbi Shmuel, you've got a problem that there are statute of limitations, right? And there are limits on these things. So that complicates the whole issue. I don't want to go into that. Because that makes life very interesting, but very complicated.
You have the famous controversy between the
Vilna Shas and that's with the Rom family, right? With the widow. It was 16 years, yeah, fascinating. And that whole chas is a whole discussion by itself. Again, another very interesting story. The bottom line of this is that the Mishnah Berurah, the Chofetz Chaim, contradicted himself. Because he wrote in his work of Jewish law, called Mishnah Berurah, that anyone can photocopy this, anyone can copy it, whoever, wherever and whatever and however. So here he is saying to his wife, he wants to protect the book, and his own book, right, of law, he said anyone can copy it. Anyone can have a copy of this because he wanted people to know the law. So Rabbi Raphael says, well, there's a difference. He says when it comes to a book of law, that's everybody needs to know how to daven, how to say a blessing, how to do brachas, whatever it may be. He says when it comes to musa, that's more specific. That's for the yeshiva boys, that's for boys who want to study in a more intense way. So that you can already create a copyright. He kind of gives a distinction that Rabbi Kagan was saying that when it comes to a book which is more intense of study, then you can limit it. But when it comes to a book of Jewish law, which you want everybody to know, then he allowed everybody to copy it. That was the suggestion. But the bottom line is, from all of this, and what can I say? The bottom line is that copyright seems to be an issue, whether you say it is based in Jewish law, or whether it is Dina de Malchuta, the law of the land, whichever way you look at it, there certainly exists an ability to create a copyright, to enforce a copyright, and of course the question, which is such a great question, about the limitations of the copyright. And that, of course, would make, you know, there will be distinctions on how you base the whole copyright issue. Where is it coming from? Is it coming from absolute halachic Jewish law, or is it coming from the law of the land? And what I've been doing ever since I researched this, and there's so much more to say, many, many more cases, but ever since, I always open up a book and look at the copyright, because it's fascinating. And as I said, Art Scroll have taken the whole nusach, the whole version of copyright, to a level which I've never ever seen. You won't see this. I just bought a secular book, you know, something to read while I'm here, and it just says copyright 2012, you know, with a little C. Here you've got no part of this volume may be reproduced. They obviously realize that, you know, people, when it comes to Torah, people do want to photocopy these things. And, you know, I have to admit that I've been guilty of maybe sort of copying maybe a part of a piece of Gemara, which, according to what we're telling me here, it was always understood, I seem to remember when discussing this originally, that if it's a part of a section that you're learning, not copyright, obviously, the whole book or anything like that, just a little piece of explanation of Talmud, that would be acceptable. It's almost what they're saying over here, except here they're talking about using it for review in a magazine. Whatever. But the reality is that copyright seems to be an issue. It does exist. It is something important. And again, I think that we should never be tested about this, to have to go to court over it. But you can see that there are precedents, and what is so interesting, and look at the history of this. We literally, as somebody put it to me once, the history of the world is really the history of Am Yisrael. That we, when you take something like printing and how the world was revolutionized when printing came in, and immediately who is like in the forefront of all the questions of legal issues about printing? The Jews. Ramon, 1580, 1700, 1800, and now still, you know, and it still goes on. And I don't know if there's any sort of modern, really modern cases like this, but I'm sure there are. Unbelievable stuff. And very, very interesting, very challenging. Very challenging to understand, and I think the bottom line is, copyright does exist. Is Art Scroll correct to threaten legal action? That I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether that is... I think there's any way they can enforce it. But when I'm saying to them, I'm literally going to copy one page, and they're already threatening me with a lawsuit, they might be taking it a bit too far. I'm not sure. Right? I leave you to make your decision. I'm not saying a word. I'm going on tape, but I've got to be careful, I'm being recorded here. But I'll have to be careful what I say. I don't know, any comments, any thoughts about this? Did anyone know Frida Kagan? Did anyone know her? Was she in New York after the war, the Rebbetzin? My guess is she died in Poland. Because he died in 1933, and even she was younger than him, you know, did she survive the war? I really don't know. Yeah, he died, he was 100, so... How, you know, even if she's 10 years younger, but one guesses that she didn't. But the book was published in 1946.
The New York Times had an obituary that he was older.
Yeah, no. Oh, really? Really? I like to see that once. That nobody really knew. Who knew how old he was? Yeah, yeah. All right, I'll leave you with that kind of stirring thought. On Sunday, really, to change the whole mood of everything that we'll be doing, we've been very business oriented for the last few days, we're going to do some miracles on Sunday. Not do miracles, we're going to study the concept, maybe you know, talk a bit about Nisim, ideas of miracles, Jewish literature, and hopefully that will balance things out. We've been very business oriented this week. Next week, Rosh HaBashamayim, we're going to talk a bit about more heavenly topics. Good Shabbos, everybody. Thank you very much.